Session number 26581.
Group Captain Nichols, Reel 13. We're talking about your time at the HQ Sacklant, Norfolk, Virginia. One thing I wanted to ask was the overall nature of the relationship with the Americans, both professional and personal. Could I ask about that?
My first contact with the American forces was back in Iceland in 1941, which were always extremely cordial. Again, when I was in India, I worked alongside the Americans off and on different projects, always again in a very cordial way. When we got Neptune aircraft, we had an American representative of the aircraft manufacturer on the base who was very much a welcome member of the community. And when I went to Sacklant, I never had any feeling that I wasn't simply working alongside aviation colleagues and Navy colleagues. The nationality never really came into it. In fact, the years I spent in America were undoubtedly the happiest years of my life. And we made very long-lasting friendships, particularly with some of the civilian population in Virginia Beach, where we had a house. And a number of these friends came over and visited us later in England.
So a very happy time for you.
Very, yes.
Now, you were out there from July 57 till January 60.
Yes.
What was your next post? You seem to have gone for another a jet refresher.
Yes. At the end of my tour of duty in NATO, I was promoted to a group captain to become the station commander of Manby. And again, not having been on flying duties for a while, I did a brief refresher course.
Now, can I just ask about that? Because in a sense it seems strange. You've done all this, you've been to the RAF Flying College, you've been trained to fly Meteors, and then you've been promptly sent on a staff posting for 2 years. And then when you come back, of course, you need a refresher. I mean, was that just how it was done? Or
yes. Yes, in the case of my refresher before taking over command of Manby, for diplomatic reasons, I couldn't very well go and be refreshed at the refresher flying school at Manby. So, in fact, I went to the Central Flying School at Little Rissington, and they gave me a quick refresher there on Meteors. This was simply so that when I arrived at Manby, I was up to date with flying jet aircraft.
And no problems for you? You haven't actually forgotten it?
No. It was a question again, really, of simply renewing my instrument rating on Meteors.
Now, who was at Manby at the time you were there? What was the organisation?
RAF Station Manby was, in many ways, a unique station and quite a large station. It consisted of two airfields, Manby, and a satellite at RAF Strubby, which was 6 or 8 miles away. As the station commander, in a way, I was also a housekeeper, because located at Manby was now called the College of Air Warfare, which was commanded by an air commodore, and a group headquarters of Flying Training Command group headquarters commanded by an air vice marshal, and the School of Refresher Flying. Now, this meant that from an officer point of view, at any one time, there might be well over 300 officers in the mess at Manby, ranging in rank from air marshal down to pilot officer. There was a great deal of flying going on. The School of Refresher Flying was split into two, the single-engined flying, the Meteors. We didn't have any Hunters there by this time, but the Meteors and the Canberras were at Strubby. And we had some 20-odd meteors, and they were on the go all day and all night with students doing their refresher flying. At Manby, we had Varsity aircraft and Piston Provost aircraft. And this was really where pupils on propeller aircraft were being refreshed. The College of Air Warfare had differed from the Flying College in that they didn't now do any flying. It was almost entirely ground instruction and studies and visits. The School of Refresher Flying was one of the things I got formally set up, because there'd been refresher flying going on, but it wasn't recognised as a particular unit, so I had it identified by the Commander-in-Chief Flying Training Command as the School of Refresher Flying. And every week we had a new intake of students for the School of Refresher Flying. The station, in addition to the number of officers I was talking about, of course we had a large number of airmen, and we also had some 700 or 800 civilians employed. So I had under command really quite a large number of people, and I also had to make it clear at all times to the all concerned that as station commander it was my station, and that the commandant of the College of Air Warfare and the AOC of the group were simply lodgers on my station. It worked all right, but I had to occasionally get the message across to some of the staff.
Are there any stories to illustrate that?
No, again, it was a very happy station. We had a very active social life, as well as a operational, well, not operational, but a training life. And we worked hard and we played hard. There's a large number of anecdotes, but I won't tell any of them because it's taking up too much time.
Are you sure? We've got time.
In addition to the routine activities of Manby, there was a time when we were selected to be the airfield for the University Air Squadrons to have their annual competitions. And so quite a large number of Chipmunk aircraft with students and their instructors came along, and also their supporters. I decided that having all these Chipmunk aircraft at Manby gave the atmosphere of a flying club, and that we should therefore turn it into an afternoon exhibition of flying display, and invite the various members of the married quarters and so on to come along to the display. Part of the exercise we laid on, of course, was the old crazy flying. And in particular, we had a system whereby we'd arranged that one of the instructors from, I think it was the Cambridge University Air Squadron, with his university blazer around his neck, to climb into a Chipmunk at dispersal and start the engine and go straight off from where he was. And the commentator saying that he didn't know what was happening, but it seemed as though this aircraft had gone off without authority. And then he said, "Oh, I've just heard that the instructor that got, the pilot that got in, was saying that he was fed up with this bloody place and was off." So the station commander immediately ordered a vampire that was about to go off and intercept this aircraft and bring it back. Whereupon we, which was all prearranged, the vampire that wasn't a vampire, it was a meteor. So that the meteor went off and at high speed and circled round this Chipmunk, and the Chipmunk came back and landed with a dead engine in the middle of the airfield on the grass. And the pilot got out and ran away, by which time the fire tender was out across the field, and some burly members of the station rugby team aboard, who did flying tackles on this character and brought him back, which went down very well with the crowd. That evening, there was a party in the mess for the air squadrons to celebrate their various competitions they'd won, and great was the goings-on. The young students were given the freedom of the mess, and we had a real party. I can remember one large trophy being filled with champagne over and over again, and regrettably, some students decided that the time had come to let the air out of one of the coaches that was standing outside that had brought them from their university. And the poor station engineer officer had to find sources of air to pump the tyres up again before they could depart. However, it was all done in a very friendly spirit.
That's it. Anything else?
Okay. Because of the large number of officers in the mess, we were able to have mess, the annual mess ball, on a very large scale. And the mess itself was one of the larger type pre-war officers' messes. So we really went to town and had a theme. I can remember one year the theme was the common market. The entire exterior of the mess was covered in camouflage netting, and which decorated, suggesting it was somewhere in France. And inside the mess, the dining hall was converted to a sort of street scene in Paris, complete with a pissoir at one end. And each room was a different country. The mess staff, we obtained uniforms from British Airways, as they were, I think, at the time, and they were all dressed as sort of airline staff, looking after people as they travelled around. It was a wild success of a party, and we had good publicity. All the furnishings and equipment and everything else we got hold of from contacts in the film studios at Denham or wherever, and from television people setting up closed-circuit television so that you could see what was going on in different rooms without bothering to go there. We had a certain amount of publicity in the press afterwards, of positive coverage. And this was the sort of thing that only a place like Memby could do.
Were you aware at the time of the gathering sort of tension with the Soviet Union? I mean, I know you were, because I'm not particularly sure when the Cold War really started to freeze over completely. I mean, it's been going on through the 50s, but how much aware were you of it in the early 60s at that time?
In a way, my post-war experience in the Royal Air Force was entirely dominated by the Cold War. That was the raison d'etre, if you like, for the Royal Air Force. We did give a certain amount of thought to some of the other problems that went on, like Mau Mau and Malaysia and so on, but dominating everything was the threat of the Russian dominance and the necessary action that had to be taken to cope with it.
Were you actually expecting war to break out at the time?
No, we never expected war to break out, but we were always prepared for it if it happened. I mean, the nearest it got, I suppose, was the President Kennedy and the Bay of Pigs.
Which
that was whilst I was commanding Manby, which we obviously took very seriously, but we never really thought it would come to war. In fact, we considered that the deterrent effect of nuclear warfare was such that really no major nations would ever use it and there would never be a major war. It's possible that little rogue states could get atom weapons of their own and cause all kinds of trouble because of irresponsibility. But the major powers of the world were too responsible ever to get themselves involved in warfare.
Anything else about Manby? You were there from April 60 through to February 63, for all those things.
No, I very much enjoyed being station commander. I found it an interesting job, an enjoyable job, and again, it simply reflected the way in which I had always found the RAF to be one glorified club.
So your next posting was February 63 to Whitehall as group captain at the Air Ministry, DDOR4. What exactly was this then?
At the end of my tour of duty at Manby, I was originally posted to a NATO job in France to do with nuclear warfare policy. And it didn't attract me at all. And I didn't want to go abroad again so soon after coming back from America. And I was able to persuade the powers that be to change the posting. To the posting that I asked for, where there was a vacancy, which was in the operational requirements branch in the Air Ministry. And the reason I was interested in this was that in the years that I'd been in the Ministry of Supply, I was working very closely with the operational requirements branch of the Air Ministry, and I knew exactly what its reason or what its aims and objectives were. And I was only too happy to find myself going into that activity.
Now, what were its aims and objectives?
Well, the operational requirements branch of the what is now the Ministry of Defence, I suppose, was to formulate the requirements of air weapons systems to counter current threats. And this, in practice, meant that you had to formulate the requirements for aircraft, for weapons systems, for equipments, navigational equipments, ground equipments, training aircraft equipments, and frequently you were devising the requirements for the aircraft to replace the current aircraft. And in my case, I was responsible for maritime aircraft and flying training aircraft and all airfield equipments.
Now, taking the maritime and flying training aircraft, well, maritime first, so what were the requirements that you discerned?
Well, my immediate task in the maritime patrol airfield area concerned the replacement for the Shackleton. My predecessors had come up with a requirement that was an all-stringing, all-dancing aircraft that was going to be so expensive that it would never get off the ground or never get accepted as a project. So I had to start again and decide what could be done on a more practical level. I decided that actually, in the case of maritime patrol aircraft, the airframe as such wasn't all that important. It was the equipment inside it that was so important. The ability to have detection equipment, navigational equipment, and so on. I also decided that a jet aircraft would be probably the better replacement for the Shackleton, because one of the requirements was to be able to get an aircraft out on task quickly. When it was on task, it didn't have to have any speed at all, because it was simply patrolling an area looking for submarines or shadowing enemy ships or whatever. But the basic intention was to get out to the middle of the Atlantic as quickly as possible. And this a jet aircraft could do. So I started on two fronts. One was to get established an organization to develop an integrated avionics system that will bring together the various sensors in the aircraft for detecting submarines and radar and the navigational equipments, and having a tactical display in the aircraft so that everything that was actually happening in the area was there on immediate display. So a committee was set up at Farnborough to start on this work. Then, as far as the aircraft was concerned, we borrowed the prototype VC-10 from Vickers, and carried out trials over the Isle of Wight, which were great fun. We flew the aircraft at some 20,000 feet and dived down to 500 feet over a buoy which represented a submarine, and did tight turns around it, and then climbed up again to 20,000 feet and did it again. And the VC-10, with its power-operated controls and swept wings, so you couldn't actually see the wings, as far as flying it was concerned, you might as well have been in a Hudson, except, of course, it was so much faster. But it was extremely manoeuvrable, and we were delighted with the results and said, yes, this would be the airframe for us. On a personal level, it was interesting because Brian Trubshaw was the chief test pilot of Vickers, and when we went along to fly the prototype, he said to me, sit in the left-hand seat. And I said, well, I expect you to sit there. He said, no, you sit there, you've flown Canberras and you'll be all right, and I'll sit in the right-hand seat. So I found actually that I was sitting in the left-hand seat doing a takeoff and eventually an instrument landing in the VC-10, having never been in the aircraft before, and Brian Trubshaw was quite happy sitting next to me. I'm sure, again, that sort of thing could never happen today.
Now, what would this... it seemed to be successful. Was that pursued, this option?
Well, yes, it was pursued, although I left the RAF... I'll go into the reasons for that later, but I left the RAF after being in operational requirements for, I don't know, a year or two. And the work was carried on by my successor. But the powers that be decided that as there were a large number of Comet airframes lying around that were not being used, that they would resuscitate the Comet and use that as the airframe for the Shackleton replacement, which they did, and it became the Nimrod. And years after the Nimrod had been in service, they got the integrated avionics equipment that had been asked for. So the Nimrod of today is a well-equipped aircraft.
But it would still have been better, in your view, if it had been the VC-10.
Well, yes, it would have been better because the VC-10 actually had a greater range and was a faster aircraft. Actually, the logic of using the Comets was, from the cost point of view, you couldn't argue it.
Now, the second part, that was your main job.
Well, no.
You also had flying training aircraft.
Yes, and it's an interesting matter. My responsibility on flying training was to look for a replacement for the NAT, the GNAT aircraft that was the advanced jet trainer for the Royal Air Force at the time. One day, the Air Marshal commanding the Air Marshal in charge of operational requirements came to the office and said that it had been suggested that we ought to think of cooperating with the French on operational requirements for the future, and was there any requirement that I had that might interest the French? And I said, well, yes, there was. I was working on a replacement for the NAT aircraft, which would in fact be a multi-purpose aircraft. It would be capable of being a training aircraft and also could be used as a tactical bomber aircraft in the way that the old Hurricanes and so on were used. We formulated a requirement for this aircraft, which was to have swing wings in order to give it the ability to have maximum range so that we could, as a tactical aircraft, get it out to areas of localized warfare. As a training aircraft, it would be adequate to meet the future requirements of the modern aircraft coming into service in the Royal Air Force. I went over to Paris to speak to the French about this, and they were quite enthusiastic, and we thought we'd made progress. But regrettably, politics came into the situation, and Monsieur Breguet, I think it was, persuaded the authorities in France that he had an aeroplane coming along that would entirely meet the requirements I'd stated, and so it, as a joint project, never got anywhere at all. However, years later, it developed in the UK, and we now have the Hawke aircraft, which was the direct outcome of our original ideas. It was the direct outcome many years later.
Now, the final thing, airfield equipment.
Yes, at this time, we were developing in Britain the ability for aircraft to be able to land blind in fog. This all-weather landing capability was being developed on a commercial level, and there were two major types of equipment being developed. One I can't remember, Smiths were developing one system, and another firm whose name I forget were developing the other. And one system was to go in the VC-10, and the other was to go in the Vanguard. I think, no, not the Vanguard, the, I can't remember its name now, anyway, the three jet-engined aircraft of British Airways. The VC-10 was decided that the order that was originally built to the requirements of BOAC, or British Airways, but in fact they decided they didn't need anything like the numbers that had been planned, and so RAF Transport Command was told that this was to be their future aircraft. So the VC-10 came in as a replacement in Transport Command. For me, it had the development of the blind landing equipment concerned me because of the effects on the airfield itself. And I got slightly involved in blind landing for maritime aircraft and others.
What did it entail? Why did it involve more equipment on the land?
Well, one of the chief things about blind landing was the fact that the ability to land aircraft, say, at London Airport in fog is one thing, but unless you've got the ability to get the aircraft taxied from the end of the runway in thick fog to its dispersal, and to get the passengers from the dispersal into the main buildings, you were going to finish up with an impossible situation on the airfield. So we had to develop some means of making sure that these aircraft that had landed in fog could get off the runway and to dispersal. And I was involved, therefore, in looking into ways and means of doing this.